Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. According to the Alzheimer's Association, it's estimated more than 7 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease, and the incidence of the disease is rising in line with the aging population. It's also estimated that 13 million people provide unpaid care for individuals with Alzheimer's and other dementia. The Alzheimer's Family Support Center is designed to get individuals and caregivers the help and support they need. And joining us, Dr. Molly Perdue, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Family Support Center. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Mindy.
Good to see you. Beverly Donheiser, she's the former caregiver to her husband, Alan, and current volunteer at Alzheimer's Family Support Center. Hi, Beverly.
Hi, Mindy.
And Dr. Andrew Palmer, he's a hand surgeon and one of the world's experts on the wrist joint. He worked part-time at the Outer Cape Health Services as an orthopedic surgeon. In 2024, he was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment. He now helps those diagnosed with MCI and Alzheimer's disease and their care partners better understand and deal with their disease. Welcome, Dr. Palmer.
Good morning.
So help us understand the differences between mild cognitive impairment, dementia, and Alzheimer's.
Oh, that's a really tough question to start with because most people, when they begin on this journey of Alzheimer's, are first diagnosed with something strange going on, and it's entitled mild cognitive impairment. And the line between mild cognitive impairment and Alzheimer's is a very fine line. And once you no longer know exactly what you're doing, and you find that you need help, then that puts you into Alzheimer's. That's the only real difference between the two. Everybody seems to start out with mild cognitive impairment, and as it progresses, it goes to Alzheimer's.
Yeah. Well, it's also different, a lot of different types of dementia, right?
Absolutely. Something like 150 different types.
Oh, my goodness.
And to Andy's point, what can happen as a person is going from mild cognitive impairment to a dementia is that they start having difficulties with activities of daily living. So the line that he's talking about, it really gets differentiated when it's hard to figure out how to do your daily activities. Mm-hmm. So it affects your life in that way. And so, you know, Andy, to your point, it is, you know, not a very straight line, right? Because there's so many differences, sometimes in minutes, hours, days, in functionality.
And also that varies person to person, right? Somebody could have this mild form longer than somebody else, right?
And some people with MCI, they may not progress. It's a very small percentage, but something like 25 to 30% of folks that get diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment, we call it MCI, they may not progress, and we don't know why they just stay mildly impaired.
Boy, if we could figure that out, that would be great, wouldn't it?
That's a million dollar question, yeah, right, Andy?
Yeah. For sure.
How did your mild cognitive impairment first manifest? What did you start to notice?
I was watching on TV, and there was an advertisement for Prevagen. So I said to a friend, and he's a physician, I said, should I be taking Prevagen? I'm forgetting people's names. And he said, oh, that's silly. You should just have a simple 3-hour cognitive impairment test. And that's how I got into it. And the cognitive test showed that I wasn't as sharp as I used to be. And they were able through those tests to determine it wasn't aging, because as you get older, of course, you do forget your car keys. That does not mean you have mild cognitive impairment or Alzheimer's.
Right. Yeah. And forgetting names, that's very common, right, as you age. Yeah.
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 And I just want to add, Dr. Palmer or Andy, you know, it's great that you were brave enough to take that probably very difficult test, right? Yeah. Because it's so easy to shirk from trying to figure out what's going on because people are so scared and there's stigma attached. And what I want to say about you at this moment is how brave you are to kind of hit this head on, because when people do that, it gives courage to others. that are also scared, because, you know, it's part of the human experience to be frightened of what we don't know. And, you know, I just kudos to you to be able to talk about this. So yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Beverly, tell us about your husband, Alan.
Well, it's interesting what Dr. Andy is saying, because in our case, Alan was a little older than I, so he was in his 70s, I was in my early 60s, and I just thought, oh, well, I guess this funny behavior, I guess he's just getting older. You know, I just decided that's what it was, and we just put our heads down and kept going, because I didn't realize this, you know, this testing would have been available, would have made a difference, who knows. But, and of course, as it did turn out, when we finally were tested, it was mild to moderate. And then, you know, as you say, Dr. Andy, it's a journey from there.
Yeah. When did Alan's symptoms first appear? You know, when did you start to notice?
That's a good question. I think about it now. Yeah. Things will pop up, and I think, oh yeah, I wonder if that's what was really going on. Because in his case, he ended up with what they call vascular dementia, his symptoms were more behavioral than. Mm. Not knowing where his car keys were or forgetting people's names. It was just, he was just different. He was changing, and I didn't know what to make of it. And so I just thought, well, I guess this is what aging looks like.
Yeah. I think a lot of people think of that too, Molly, right? It's like it's the memory stuff, but behavior is a big part of this as well.
Yeah, so every area of the brain that we rely on can dysfunction. Yeah. And that's why there's so many different types of dementia. And there's so much vascularity that is in our brain that there's a lot of things that can go wrong that can affect functionality as well. Mm-hmm. And I think to Beverly's point, what can happen for people is they may not even recognize, because sometimes the area of the brain that has insight is affected, so you don't even see that there's a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be a silver lining for the person living with cognitive loss, and that they don't really see what's going on for them. Mm-hmm. Clearly, that's not happening for Andy, but in Beverly's case, you know, her husband may not have noticed that he had a decline, or by the time he was able to recognize it because of the compensation, you know, people want to live a good life.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we say, oh, you know, they're trying to hide their dementia. Nobody's hiding anything. You're trying to get up, mm-hmm. have your morning breakfast, dressed,
yeah.
and figure out your day. And as you are living with cognitive loss, many of those things become more challenging. And so still, 50% of people are not formally diagnosed.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
So we're dealing with a large portion of the population that still may not have a formal diagnosis, that is really out there trying to figure out what are they going to do.
Yeah.
Yes, and in Alan's case, he was very, very healthy. We were outdoorsy people, always out walking. We were traveling. We were going to museums, and that's just who he was. He continued to be that way, which is another piece that made it confusing. That mm-hmm. you know, and I guess chose or was instinctively able to just say, oh, well, it's whatever it is, and we're just going to go on with our life.
Deal with it, yeah. Molly, so many families, family members are caring for loved ones with Alzheimer's or other forms of dementia. The numbers are kind of staggering, right?
Yeah.
So we see the numbers rising across the country. I'm sure that's what you're seeing locally, too, right?
Absolutely. And we're seeing that it's affecting younger people. So, you know,
when you say affecting younger people, you mean as caregivers?
So I'm saying people are becoming symptomatic that aren't just over 65.
Really? Okay.
So we have many people in our care that are now in their 50s. And so we don't typically think of younger folks suffering from dementia, but it is happening because we have such a wide population that is dealing with the effects, and we don't yet understand fully the cause or the causation. So we really haven't been able to figure out from a public health perspective how to do something to help people manage their cognitive health. I mean, there are some new studies that are out there about lifestyle factors that I think are critical for people to pay attention to. And this year's conference, we're going to have Lisa Genova that's going to talk a lot about cognitive health, because you want to take care of your brain as much as we know how to right now.
Yeah. Beverly, how did your role as a caretaker evolve as Alan's disease progressed?
I have no idea.
You're just in the moment doing what you have to do.
As I said, Dr. Andy couldn't have put it better. It is a journey.
Yeah.
How did my role evolve? It got harder. Mm-hmm. It got harder. Fortunately, as I came to say, you know, it's unlucky if you have to have dementia in your life. But it turns out it's really lucky if you live on Cape Cod, mm-hmm. because about 8 years ago, about a year officially into our journey, or less than a year, I just saw a little ad in a local paper, a weekly paper, that said there was a support group sponsored by Alzheimer's Family Support Center at the Falmouth Senior Center, and you didn't have to be a Falmouth resident to come. And there would be a meeting at the same time, a group for my husband, so that I didn't need to worry about what he was getting into by himself at home while I wasn't home. Mm-hmm. And that made all the difference, because I am sort of a do-it-yourselfer, being the only girl with four brothers, I guess. You know, mm-hmm. it just was imprinted in me. It's always been hard for me to say, I can't do this myself. But you can't.
You can't do it yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't have to do it myself because of Alzheimer's Family Support Center.
Molly, she's bringing up a really good point. Support groups are so critical.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it also, just knowing you're not alone, that in itself is helpful, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Beyond helpful,
yeah.
Mandy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the premises of the Alzheimer's Family Support Center is to try to meet people where they're at. And that includes caregivers as well as people living with cognitive loss. And so getting out in the community, having funding so we can be in every COA and we can be in every town, and we can say, you don't have to travel too far to be able to connect to support. You know, like Beverly's case of walking in locally and going, okay, what do I do? How do I do this? Mm-hmm. Having education.
But my sister-in-law in Roanoke, Virginia, could get hooked up, and she's been Zooming, and she and with Molly, and that has made a huge difference for her.
Yeah. Well, after COVID, we put everything online because folks couldn't get out. So all those groups that were out in the community. We have 40 currently. We still have over 40 offerings a month that we have online for people. So you don't want to get out of your pajamas, or you can't get your person to go to that secondary group to have a fun experience. You can join and go online and reach support and know that you're not the only one.
And let's not forget, it's free.
Oh, yeah, that's important. And Dr. Palmer, I want to ask you, when you got this diagnosis of MCI, at what point did you go, you know what, I'm jumping in and helping others with this? You know, was it, because I imagine when you first get that diagnosis, it's pretty shocking.
It is pretty shocking. And, it turns your whole life inside out. And my wife was fortunate that she knew Melanie and Molly and went to one of the caregivers supports. And she encouraged me to go to the Alzheimer's support myself as a patient and listen to this. But it was really her. She led me down that path. And you know, as a practicing physician, never in my life did I think I'd go to a support group about Alzheimer's. And it's one of the best, most comforting things I can do now and do for myself, but for all the other people sitting around that table, because everybody shares their story. All the stories are different. And yet all of us can understand where the people are coming from.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org, and we'll talk more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about Alzheimer's this morning and the Alzheimer's Family Support Center, designed to get individuals and caregivers the help they need for support. With us, Dr. Molly Perdue, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Family Support Center, Beverly Donheiser, former caregiver to her husband, Alan, and current volunteer at Alzheimer's Family Support Center, and Dr. Andrew Palmer, who has been diagnosed with MCI, and he's also volunteering with the Alzheimer's Family Support Center. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Molly, people with dementia and Alzheimer's have very different needs, right? Very different, as the disease progresses. And these needs change, right? So talk a little bit about that, because we said how it progresses is different in everybody. You know, how it presents. There's all these differences.
Oh, yeah.
And so there's all these needs.
There's an amazing amount of information you have to hold. And you can't hold all of it, because these progressions go from 2 to 20 years. That's right. A lot of life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And figuring out how to navigate where someone's at and how to help someone, dependent on where their abilities are as well as what their disabilities are, is so important. It's so easy to focus sometimes, Mindy, on what is lost. Mm-hmm. But what is still there mm-hmm. is also present. So one of the things we try to do is educate caregivers so they can kind of sort some of this out. And, you know, in Beverly's case, trying to figure out what's going on, how do I best meet the needs of my husband? How do I help him mm-hmm. so that he can have the best life possible?
Yeah.
And that is something that we try to do from the caregiver perspective. And, you know, concerning, you know, what Andy's doing and his volunteering and staying with purpose and meaning as you progress mm-hmm. can be so important. So trying to focus on those abilities right. as they go, and then help people kind of sort it out. I think the number one rule is that you have to meet folks where they're at. And that can be so hard. You know, you're married for 50, 60 years, you have expectations,
right.
you know, you want your husband making the bed every morning. And you know, sometimes we have in our groups, the person living with cognitive loss say, I don't want to have to make that bed anymore. Because, right, Andy? Because my wife, you know, she just needs me to do this,
yeah.
and it's hard.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there is a lot of variability around what happens, and there things change, and the uncertainty. And I'm sure Andy would agree with this. The uncertainty can be, well, I could remember his name yesterday, and now, like I can't.
Right.
Or the uncertainty with the caregiver is, well, yesterday we could do this thing. This morning, you know, he or she's having a hard time, and Beverly's shaking her head because this is this is what happens. So uncertainty, is really hard for us as human beings.
Well, and also uncertainty leads to what? I'm not going to go. Isolation, right? And we mm-hmm. know isolation is mm-hmm. never good for anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's mm-hmm. horrible. And you know, one of the strongest statements I've ever heard about isolation came out of a Harvard study where a class of sophomores, I think 1938, donated their brains to science. And every year they would do, you know, some type of evaluation to see how they were doing. And this went on clearly for many, many years. And one of the findings that Robert Waldinger, who was the head researcher at the time, found is that loneliness kills. Mm. Like, he was looking for what are the things that can help us go into our old age gracefully and as healthy as we can be. And isolation and loneliness are really detrimental to the human body. Mm. And that is true for people living with cognitive loss as well as their caregivers.
So, yeah, people and give it, yeah. Dr. Palmer, getting that diagnosis, as we mentioned, again, it's a real blow. And so how are you talking to folks who are going through that? Because I think it's so important, too. Again, we go back to the support groups. It's so important for somebody, you know, somebody tells you what's happening. But when you're talking to somebody who's going through it, it has a lot more power.
I actually consider it an honor to be able to share my early journey with this disease with people. because people are afraid of it. You can't catch it from somebody else or anything like that. But people are worried that maybe they can catch it from someone. And there's so much that if you have this, you can do for yourself. You can exercise, you can eat a great diet, you can make sure you get 8 hours of sleep, you can make sure your hearing works well. And rather than isolation, you can make sure you do socialization. That's really, really important. And there are a few other things. Never take medication that makes your brain sort of shut down at night, like a sleeping pill or something like that. Find other ways to make yourself relaxed to go to sleep. So there's so many things you can do. And I find for me, sharing my story with people, it is a little scary, but it's life as you get older. And there's so much that can still be done for it. And that's not to say anything about the medications that are coming along.
What about folks who are in denial? Molly, I'm sure you get caregivers who go, I really would love my husband, my wife, my spouse to, you know, come in, take part in this, but they're in denial. And we know early detection is key.
It takes some coaching for people to understand what they need before they need it, because we don't come into this world understanding how dementia affects the brain or understanding how it affects behavior or understanding that someone cannot see sometimes their own progression or what they're going through. And so, you know, learning how to not ask permission, but maybe help someone get to a program that they enjoy. I had to do this with my own mother who was living with dementia. She hated going to the doctor's office because she hated waiting. But I knew if I could get her to Wendy's for a Frosty, I could get her to the doctor. So when we left the house in the morning, we were going to Wendy's. And then when the Frosty kicked in, you know, get a little dopamine, right, Andy, from that sugar, the doctor's office wasn't so bad. Well, you know,
clever.
those are tips that people can get from support groups. They can get that from each other. And so they can go, oh, that's how I do it. And so this is where education and connection and learning and community becomes so vital, because you don't want, what did you say, 7 million people across the country times three caregivers having to learn all these things from scratch every day, right? There's no sense in that. You know, we can help each other if we come together and we share and we find a way to go through this together. It's equivalent to bringing the casserole to your neighbor's house when they're in trouble, right? You bring the information, you're able to figure out how to get through the hard spots. We know that we can get through this better together than we can alone. And, you know, this is what we decided we were going to build this and do this every day. And that's what we're doing.
So we've touched on some of this, but Alzheimer's Family Support Center offers a suite of services and programs. So let's start with some of the programs available for those living with Alzheimer's. Talk about some of the services you have.
Well, we are doing, as we talked about, support groups in every town. We have education in person, online. We have consultations that we do. We have incredible social workers that are out there meeting with families, being able to create care plans. We do memory screenings for people that are confidential. So if you're a little nervous about your memory, you want to have a confidential conversation, we can do that for you. And if you know, if you need to get connected back to your doctor, we're able to do that. We have social engagement programs that we have now started all across the Cape. We have one in Truro. I'm really hoping we're going to get something together in Falmouth. So for all you listening that are in Falmouth, we're looking for a way to be able to do a free drop-off 3-hour program where people can come, find meaning and purpose that are living with cognitive loss. And at the same time, their caregivers can go to the store, go to that doctor's appointment, get the break that they need. That's something that we're doing. And we're also doing right now, which is really interesting, a guide program. So our newest program, and we're so excited because we're partnering with Elder Services. Actually, Elder Services brought us in with them to be able to offer this program. And GUIDE is this innovative program through the Center for Medicare. And it provides funding so that we can not only do these consultations, and we can do a home visit, and we can do an assessment at no additional cost, but the program provides a $2,563 respite stipend for every person that signs up and participates. And that allows the family to be able to connect to a day program or an in-home home care program and be able to spend that money while they're getting a respite. And it's, you know, there are some qualifications. It's unlike everything else that we do and unlike everything else that Elder Services does, which, you know, we're both nonprofits that do things free of charge. But this program, it has, you have to qualify with Medicare A and B. But it's a simple application to either us or Elder Services to be able to see if you qualify. And then you can get your respite monies. That will be provided every year, and it's a six-year program. Mm. So it's a case management program. You get a case manager, you get this respite stipend, you get a home visit so that you're able to, we're able to kind of suss out home safety, and you have two great providers on Cape Cod and you know, that are available to do that.
Wow. And you mentioned something in here, but I want to reiterate it. Free.
Yeah.
Everything you guys do is free.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Never a cost.
Yeah. Beverly, you're nodding your head.
I was just thinking about, we're talking about denial, and I know that that's, and what Molly's talking about, you know, with all the services that are available, I think that's why it's so important. Dr. Andy, you're in a unique position to be able to do this, particularly because you are working with Alzheimer's Family Support Center. And honestly, it's why I do it. And I wear my T-shirts out in the community, and people start talking to me about, oh, what is that on your shirt? And it's because the more that people can know what's available, they might have a friend, they might have a family member, but, you know, it's not always a direct route to get to these services. Maybe somebody doesn't, they are in denial, excuse me, but maybe they like music. Or maybe I happen to help facilitate a program with the Falmouth Arts Center that and a wonderful ceramicist named Kim Sheeran and Alzheimer's Family Support Center that involves ceramics and coming and playing with clay, which is how some people see it. Oh, I'm not going to go do that. But once they get there and they've got clay in their hands, they're having a wonderful time. And they want to come back again.
Yeah.
And they can't wait to see what they made today.
Yeah.
So I've seen it. I've seen it so many times. I know personally what a difference all the cultural programming meant to my husband, who, as I said, was so, we went to the great museums of the world because of my husband. Mm-hmm. And we could go to the Cape Museum of Fine Art in Dennis. Every Friday, it was on my calendar. We look forward to it. Yes, there were cookies. and if Alan wasn't feeling it because that day, oh, maybe we were doing a project that involved making a collage or something, Melanie Braverman, who was there, she could just eyeball Alan, and she knew he needed to just get up, go get a cookie, and the two of them would go and look at the art together so that I could have some quality time.
Yeah.
You know, while he was having his quality time. That's what Alzheimer's Family Support is all about. And the more we can help by being out in the community, you and me, Dr. Andy, and Molly, of course, and Mindy, the more we can spread the word and find a way, something that will help people to get in. I tell them all the time, you haven't been to the mall? You haven't seen the community center at the mall? You got to go. Just wander in.
All right, so the mall.
The mall.
Yeah.
The mall.
It's
brilliant. You can go to Target. You can go to Macy's. You can drop off. Someone can enjoy a musical program while you're going to see your doctor in Hyannis. What's great about the mall is that it just brings this giant program, because we're in a larger space now, and plops it down where people actually are. Yeah. And it's all roads lead there. There's buses that come mm-hmm. to the mall. So the beauty of it is that it's not hidden, you know, and it's not just on Main Street anymore. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, we need to have programs that are available where people are. So Musical Mondays, you can walk in, you can listen to music, you can sign your person up. You know, clearly we do sign-ups. I mean, you know, we have to gather some information to make it safe. Wendy LaFrancois does an incredible job running our rest programs all over. We're in Truro. We're in Plymouth now. We're in Duxbury. We're all over the place. We provide transportation. You know, we have transportation. It's light. It's one person that, you know, is able to bring quite a few people to our programming. That happens there. And we have Nicole, who is setting up what we call dementia-inclusive education, so that everybody gets to come. You know, so many educational programs are caregiver-only. Mm-hmm. So we have dedicated Tuesdays to dementia-inclusive education, where all of our programs include everyone. So you don't have to figure out, how do I come to something without my person?
All right. So people are going, wow, that's a lot for free. So how do you fund all this?
You know, we've never had a fundraiser. We've had an outreach person that has helped us with walks. You know, we've had some disruption in federal funding and state funding in the last couple of years, and we have figured out how to just keep moving. I think, you know, it's a challenging time for a lot of nonprofits, but it just means you dig in deeper. We've created ambassadors. Everybody on my team is phenomenal. Yeah. And my staff has worked a little harder. We do a walk at Scusset Beach that we just finished that met its mark, was successful. We're going to do another one in Provincetown. We've got Lisa Genova pitching in to do our conference about cognitive health. We had a casino night. Melanie went to a casino night last night at senior residences, and she said it was incredible. People were having so much fun. So we just bring our community in, and we're able to raise the funds that we need and keep these things going. We're a direct service organization. There's no one sitting around collecting a paycheck that's not out there working. Even our financial manager, Peg Holmes, is helping out at a Friday social engagement program. It's how we work. And so we're really proud of what we've been able to do now for 11 years.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, you've come such a long way and do so much. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about Alzheimer's this morning and the Alzheimer's Family Support Center, designed to get individuals and caregivers the help and support that they need. With us is Dr. Molly Perdue, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Family Support Center, Beverly Donheiser, former caregiver to her husband, Alan, and current volunteer at Alzheimer's Family Support Center, Dr. Andrew Palmer, hand surgeon, one of the world's experts on the wrist joint. He, in 2024, was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment and now works as a volunteer at the Alzheimer's Family Support Center. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Molly, do you find sometimes, you know, there'll be somebody who, is that uncertainty. Am I going to get there and be embarrassed? I don't remember somebody's name. Is this going to happen? Is that going to happen? And they're hesitant to seek any kind of assistance outside of the family.
Yeah.
That's common, right?
It is common. And it takes some time. And I would defer to Dr. Palmer to you know, how did he get started? Like what was the first step that felt like, okay, you know, I now can get into this?
Dr. Palmer, what's the answer?
It was a mind shift to thinking about, how can I help someone else who might have this same problem? And I had to move beyond poor me. Why did this happen to me? To, okay, so I've got this. Now, what can I do to maybe help other people learn more about this and move on past it. And that's for me, that's part of being a physician. I've always felt that way. And it's a great opportunity. Anyone who has this condition can help someone else with it. And the caregivers pay such a huge, they do such a great thing helping those of us who have this disease, but the caregivers need help too.
Yeah.
And we can help those of us that have the disease by recognizing what caregivers are giving us. I like the term care partners, because you're partnering oftentimes with your spouse in this. And it's not a dismal situation by any means.
So to Andy's point, the concept of empowerment, right? The concept of meeting people where they're at, helping them become comfortable with who they are at this moment in time, and giving them an avenue for being able to reach out and provide community with all of their care partners or caregivers, whichever you'd like to use. So it's so important that we bring everyone together and we help find a way to eliminate or at least leave the fear at the front door. And that is probably the power of what we actually do. You know, we know it's hard to walk through a threshold. So what can you do? You can meet someone right there and say you're welcome here.
Come on in. This is such a perfect segue because caregivers is what I wanted to bring up next and talk a little bit about support for caregivers. You know, as a kid, and Bev, you probably know this, as a caregiver, it's like, you're feeling so like, oh, my poor husband, he's, you know, I want to do everything I can to help. And so you're forgetting about your own needs, right? Because you're feeling, well, they need so much more than I do. I'm just going to keep helping them. And we get burnout, right? And we get, you know, lots of things going on. So talk a little bit about that. And I know in the past you said it's really important for caregivers to receive supports early on. And this is part of that whole education idea, right?
Yeah.
And we've all heard so many times, if there's a need for oxygen masks, be sure and put yours on first before you try to help anyone else. And I think the reason they say that is because it is just counterintuitive. We just want to help.
Yeah.
Particularly women.
Yeah.
Because that's what we're used to doing.
And husbands. You can't leave the husbands out of this. Right. Statistically, they're right in there.
I know it. So, but it turns out, I can say now, having, you know, been a caregiver, that that's exactly what you have to do. And yet you do need someone else. And Dr. Andy, my hat is off to you. What you're saying about caregivers and what you're saying about wanting to share what's going on with you, with everyone, that I can't even begin to tell you what I think about the value of that. And I'm sure it's not easy, but thank you.
Yeah. And whatever the other thing that happens for people is that there's an enormous ball of grief to watch either yourself losing your abilities or watching the person you love losing their abilities. So if we don't tackle that emotional, you know, factor of grief, it's really hard to get people to move.
Right.
You know, so I think the help being what you need when you need it, not just, you know, hey, everybody needs self-care. We know that. I can remember as a caregiver, I had my friends telling me that, but that didn't necessarily help. Because you have to tackle why it's hard for you to realize that it's not just the person you're caring for, it's the whole family. And this is why when we coined the term family support center, we wanted to get the word family in there because everyone gets affected.
Right.
You know, I can hear from grandchildren, you know, when we do our family meetings, they're worried about their own cognition. So sometimes the person in your family that may not be helping they're dealing with their own fear, and so it's hard for them to tackle their own fear. And once again, you know, it comes down to there's lots of feelings. It's very complicated. And if we don't find avenues for people to be able to express any of that, then it all gets internalized, and it ends up sometimes in us not being able to rise up and be our best selves.
Yeah. Well, not only that, but there are a lot of practical, not even about feelings necessarily, but, you know, there are so many who have children, but the children are living far away, and they feel disconnected. They feel there's nothing they can do to help. And yet I've learned, thanks to Melanie and Molly, that let's find ways for them. Like, how many times have I heard Melanie say that, well, okay, so they're in another time zone. Perhaps they could call, could they make a phone call at 5 o'clock so that you could maybe have a half hour to be, you, the caregiver, could have that half hour in the kitchen to make dinner while they're on the phone with your loved one. And so that way everybody gets something out of that. But you have to be a little more creative. And if you're the caregiver and you're in the middle of, oh my gosh, I just have to get this. You're never going to think of that. But if you have other people who are helping you, you know.
Good suggestions,
No one wants to burden their children.
Right. And that too.
Right. Yeah. And one of the things
but
we
a
say.
A phone call you can ask for.
Well, you know.
Some people can't, though. It's hard.
Yeah. Everyone can't do everything. Right. But one of the things we say in our family meetings is that everyone can't do everything, but everyone can do something.
Right.
What can you agree to do?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Got an email from Joan who says, I cannot say enough about the help I was given by Molly and the team during our 4 years of dealing with my husband's illness. Joan, thank you for that email. I'm sure you get emails like that all the time, Molly. So many families that you've been working with over the years. Alzheimer's Association reports almost two-thirds of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. Do we know why women are at a greater risk, or is that still a puzzle?
It's a puzzle. There are research centers that are trying to figure out, is there some type of hormonal basis for this? One of the rationales is that women live longer. So that could be one of the reasons. But, you know, I don't know, you know, maybe Dr. Palmer could shed some light. But I don't know exactly why that statistic is so true. But, yeah, it is something that I think we're trying to look at.
Yeah. Dr. Palmer, you got any insight into that?
I don't have a good answer for it, but I will tell you that, Molly, you're completely right. People are looking into this. There is a book entitled The XX Brain, and it's about women and their hormonal journey through life and its association with Alzheimer's. Why do women, when they're having their period, have problems with some, have no problems, others feel this brain fog come on and everything? And it's because there's a connection between the hormonal cycles of women and their brain. Mm-hmm. So there's, and then to realize that two-thirds of women have the disease, two-thirds of the people with Alzheimer's are women, there's a huge connection. Yeah. And this the book is brilliantly written. I really have enjoyed it very much. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't have answers except to say she thinks there's a direct connection.
Yeah. What are some of the risk factors, Molly?
So one of the things I do want to mention, which will address that, is the POINTER study. Finally, the United States is doing some research. The Alzheimer's Association started a study a couple of years ago. It's called the POINTER study, if people want to look it up. And it looked at lifestyle factors. And they found research subjects that weren't exercisers. They were at high risk of dementia. And they brought them into this study, and they put them in two groups. One was self-directed. The other had some type of coaching. And they looked at diet. They looked at exercise. They looked at social engagement. And they studied these two groups over a couple years. And they found the findings were really remarkable in the sense that when people change their lifestyle, they seem to be able to hold on to their cognition, you know, and it was a little more stable. And so we're continuing this research, which I think was amazing. I was at the international conference in Toronto last summer, and I heard the paper, you know, and the findings being announced. And I think one of the closest research sites was right in Rhode Island. So, you know, can we make a difference by increasing our, you know, or reducing our risk of dementia by paying attention to diet? They were on the MIND diet, and the exercise was 150 minutes, you know, a week, and doing some type of weight training. And then, of course, you know, making sure that they were connecting with others. And I think there was some other cognitive stimulation
involved.
We're
talking about diet. Dr. Rudy Tanzi, who I know, you know, does is amazing, has you know, done a lot of research in Alzheimer's. He says, what's good for the heart is good for the brain. So if you can, that's how I try to remember. Hmm. What's good for the heart is good for the brain, as far as the diet goes. Hmm. Talk a little bit about research into treatment for Alzheimer's. It's been underway for decades. Any developments that are looking promising or hopeful on the horizon?
So we are looking at a lot of infusions. I believe Dr. Sean Horrigan is engaging in that with people through some Biogen. You know, the medications, they are looking at trying to reduce, I would say, or add maybe a year and a half of better functionality to people, you know, with some of these newer substances that are being used. And, you know, I would say that we're learning a lot. You know, when I hear Lisa Genova talk about the new medications, she says we're really getting to know some ways of reducing beta amyloid that seems to be promising, and you know, it's a good start. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how she describes
yeah.
it.
Yeah, a good start. Yeah. One of the things else I wanted to think of is people shouldn't fall for some of these. I was looking at something, some ad was like, oh, this honey mixture will bring back your memory. And like, those are all just, it's like snake oil, right? None of that is true.
That's why the Poynter study is yeah. good. It's good science. It's lifestyle factors. You know, they feel that exercise is really, really important. Diet, really, really important. So take a look at the research that's mm-hmm. happening. If, you know, if you're worried about your brain, I think there's things that you can do to try to decrease risk. Europe has looked at for years, they started these studies. Actually, it was the finger study. Now we have the Poynter study. But they were looking at lifestyle factors for years. And they guessed that the risk factor concerning lifestyles, maybe 35%,
wow.
that you can influence your dementia risk by paying attention to lifestyle.
Well, and Molly, you're too modest to say this, but you actually offer presentations with Alzheimer's Family Support Center on this very subject, and which I attended, and I found it so encouraging because I was doing everything on the list except learn something new.
Yeah. So learn something new. That's key, right?
And here
right?
she is. So, she's with Mindy Todd.
Does this count?
Yeah, just about a minute left. Who wants the final word?
Andy?
I think this program is wonderful. The fact that you are exposing to everybody this disease that has become 7 million Americans with this, it's going to perhaps, it's going to get bigger and bigger. Mm. I take my hat off to you for that, but also to the Alzheimer's Support Center. Mm. It's a wonderful place yeah. for all of us who live on the Cape to have available to us.
Yeah. And Molly, again, thank you so much for the work that you and Melanie and the rest of the team do. It's so important. And I'm just 11 years later. Yay.
Here we are. Yeah, and all I would say is don't go it alone.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
have support out there.
And you'd be surprised how much you can accomplish with the support. All right. Dr. Molly Perdue, Beverly Dunheiser, and Dr. Andrew Palmer, thanks for being with us. We'll have a link with more info at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Is produced by me, Amy Vince, with production assistance from Dan Tridle and Elsa Partan. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.